Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm Dan Ferris. I'm the editor of Extreme Value and the Ferris Report, both published by Stansberry Research.
And I'm Corey McLaughlin, editor of the Stansberry Daily Digest. Today we talk with Crane Shares Chief Investment Officer Brendan Ahern.
Brendan is actually an old friend of the firm. Steve Sugar met him many years ago. They went to China. Steve learned all about the firm. He liked what he saw. And it's no wonder that he liked what he saw, because you're about to find out that Brendan is a great guy, very knowledgeable about China and investing in general. And so let's do it. Let's talk with Brendan Ahern. Let's do it right now. Brendan, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
And many thanks for the opportunity, Dan and Corey.
Yeah. So I'm intrigued by you just because I don't know what the chief investment officer of a company like Crane, and when I look at, you know, Crane Shares, like, to me, the Crane Shares is like the China ETF company, right? What does someone in your position at such a company do? I honestly don't know.
It's a great question, actually. I think ultimately, yes, we are an asset manager focused on investing in growth equities within China and broader emerging markets. But I think the most important thing we do is try to provide a balanced, data-driven perspective on what's happening in China's economy and capital markets. We're not into selling greed or fear or apocalypse. You know, we don't use hyperbole and exaggeration. We're data junkies, and we want to provide that to investors so they can make a rational decision whether or not to invest with us or not. And we're small business owners. We built something from zero. And so we're also very, I think, upfront with people about the volatility of investing with us, that, you know, things can go well, but they can also not go well. Emerging markets inherently are very volatile. But it's really about the data and the research. And, you know, we go to China. We meet with the companies we're invested in. And we try to provide those perspectives where, I think, in general, you know, Western media is a source of disinformation. It's not a good source for what's going on over there.
Right. So I have to ask Corey, like, he's not selling fear and greed. Do we even want to talk to this guy? I mean, come on. Do we have any use for this?
Yes. I mean, I have a lot more use for it myself, but yeah.
I know. We have more use, in fact. Yeah. And what you just said about Western media versus getting information from China, that's like, you're in. We definitely want to know more. Of course, we should probably gradually get to this, but I can't help myself. I can never help myself. So, you know, if there are other things you want to get to, fine. But China's central bank did some stuff recently, huh?
and
I feel like they,
finally,
the equities took off like a rocket. So something big is up in the market.
Yeah, I mean, you know, finally the PBOC, and they clearly waited for the Fed to cut rates. I mean, that's very clear. And why did they wait? Well, you know, currency movements are driven by, you know, interest rate differentials. So by waiting for the Fed to cut, it, you know, didn't, if they had cut before the Fed, the renminbi, their currency, would have depreciated versus the dollar, and U.S. politicians would say, you know, they're manipulating their currency. So they actually waited for the Fed and then are following suit by cutting a broad measures of interest rates. But I think it doesn't really have much to do with the U.S. economy or U.S. They're doing this because the situation in China has gotten not dire. It's not going great. And they're finally coming up with a prescription to a number of problems that have weighed on the economy, on their stock market, on their real estate market, and on consumer confidence. So the, you know, the end citizen in China has kind of been giving the government the thumbs down, and this is the first movement, you know, last Tuesday and Thursday of getting off the proverbial pot.
If do they get their thumbs cut off when they do that in China, or is,
I mean
are they allowed to do that in China?
The government. I mean, I think the government is attuned to public sentiment, and there's examples of that. You know, a lot of the reduction in pollution in China, particularly in Beijing, is because people got angry. You know, people were like, "It's snowing in summer, and that's not snow; it's ash." You know, I can't look across the street. You know, and that was the case 8 years ago, 9 years ago. That's no longer the case, and. You know, I had asthma as a kid and I actually jogged in Beijing, you know, 4 years ago. You know, it just shows this, you know, so they are aware of public's view and every government globally, you know, if there's economic demise, you get fired as a politician, you know, that was, you know, true with Boris Johnson or, you know, President Trump because of the collapse of the economy because of COVID or, you know, Asian tigers in the late 90s. When there's economic collapse, there is regime change. And that's true in China. That's true in China. So the government is acting because of very, very low consumer confidence in China, driven by the fall in real estate prices.
Right, we're not saying we expect President Xi to, you know, give up his lifetime appointment.
No,
we're just saying that they changed their actions to respond to the people.
Correct. Yeah.
The reaction to there's two things really in the PBOC's action here. One of them, of course, is the sort of promise to do more. I forget the guy's name, Zhao Feng. The PBOC governor's name. But he made it clear, like, we're going to do more.
Pan Gongsheng.
Gongsheng, right, is what I was trying to Pan. Okay, we'll call him Pan. He sounded like we're going to do more and more and more. Like, the promise was for more, and the market seems to have taken it very, very seriously. And I mean, some of these things are just up, you know, 20, 30, 50%, just like that.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Is this like an overreaction? Are you shocked at the reaction? How do you take it?
Well, I think, you know, there's, what they did is they talked about, you know, they cut all these interest rates. You know, they really are very focused on stabilizing real estate prices because 2/3 of urban household wealth is in real estate. And that's why consumer confidence has come down. And that's why domestic consumption has been so low. So if you can get property prices up, you raise consumer confidence, you raise domestic consumption. But they also said, we want to raise the stock market. Because the stock market is like an indicator of animal spirits, of consumer confidence. And the PBOC said, you know, we're going to give 500 billion RMB, so kind of divide by seven, and that gives it dollars. You know, so we're talking about almost 7 billion. But to insurance companies, brokerage firms, and mutual fund families to buy stocks. Just, you know, we'll just give you 7 billion. And if that doesn't get the stock market up, we're going to give them another 500 billion. And if that doesn't get stock markets up, we'll just give them more. So, so it's like you have this huge flashing green light. That is mainly focused to Shanghai and Shenzhen stocks. And this is like where, you know, there's, you know, self-serving and highly biased, you know, as an asset manager, this would be like, you know, KBA is our China A. So Chinese A shares are Shanghai, Shenzhen stocks. So this is very much directed to the mainland China stock, Shanghai, Shenzhen, 95% owned by investors in China. Now, there's also Chinese companies in Hong Kong, and they've had a really, really strong reaction. And then you have US ADRs as well. And that reaction has been very, very strong, partially driven by, you know, up until 2 weeks ago, you know, Bank of America does a global portfolio manager survey. They say, you know, to mutual fund managers, what are your favorite trades? The number one trade was Mag 7, and the number two was short China. And so a lot of that short selling was in Hong Kong and ADRs. So offshore China. This is, you know, again, self-serving asterisk part, you know, KWEB, contrasting KBA and KWEB. So those investors, hedge funds, or those investors who were short China, just got run over. You know, they're going to get carried out. But more importantly, why you've seen this reaction is that investors globally have been very underweight China. That, you know, China's economy is $18 trillion GDP, but India at $3.5 trillion actually was a bigger part of global indices at $3.5 trillion. Does that, I mean, it makes no sense, but it just shows this, there's this incredible underweight to Chinese equities globally. Some of that money that came out of China, it went into US tech or India or Japan, and what you're seeing is a re-rating back in. And that's where, yeah, we've had this incredible reaction. There's going to be pullbacks and corrections, but I think if you believe they're going to stick to this stimulus, and we only saw monetary, the fiscal's still coming. You know, the fiscal details are still pretty vague. That's still coming. You know, this, if this re-rating, we're talking about a lot of money coming back into China, not today or tomorrow, but in the next months, quarters, and years, where, you know, in general, people have been really underweight U.S. stocks, non-U.S. stocks in general. Yeah. And so this re-rating will play out over time, but you see this immediate reaction, you know, from the fast-moving crowd. And that's not a lot of people can move that fast.
Yeah. So I want the idea of underweighting, you know, the 18 trillion versus the 3 trillion in India, that intrigues me, because if that's ever fixed, look out, right? I mean, that's a lot of capital. It sounds like it's de facto fixes itself, though, to a certain extent.
Right. It'll rectify itself, I think, but it'll take time, Dan. I mean, that's where, like, listen, you know, a hedge fund can change its opinion, or an individual investor, but think about, you know, the pension funds and endowments, and exactly. You know, they gotta get the investment committee. You know, that might be every quarter. They gotta talk to their trustees or their directors. And that's just not U.S. That's global. You know, if it's mm-hmm. you know, and that's why I'm more constructive of, in the long run, that if you know more fiscal support is coming, you know, that super tanker of underweight, you know, it doesn't turn on a dime. It'll take time, and some of the problems in China aren't going to solve themselves overnight. Real estate is an issue. And they're starting to fix it, and there'll be ups and downs in that effort.
And there is, correct me if I'm wrong here, there is genuine oversupply in the real estate, right? I mean, that's real.
It's very real. You know, China has urbanized over the last 40 years, you know, moving people out of rural areas into cities in order to raise their standard of living, giving them access to healthcare and education. And that's led to this overbuilding. The only thing I can think about, Dan, is it's like, you know, my mom is from Denver. So I've been going to Denver for, you know, almost 50 years. And if you know Denver, you know, you used to fly into Stapleton Airport. You know, the Brown Palace was the nicest place to eat in Denver. And, you know, we'd drive up to Boulder to see a CU game. You know, where my mom went to school, go Buffs. And there was nothing in between Boulder and Denver. And then people discovered Denver's a beautiful place to live. And so they started building, and the city got bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, now it goes all the way out to Boulder. It goes, you know, they put DIA, the airport, out in the middle of nowhere. Now the city goes all, and that's like 130 cities in China, because hundreds of millions of people coming out of really poor is coming in. And that's where, if you know these cities in China, China just minted instant millionaires in real estate. You know, it's like the broken slot machine, you know, it just, and for the first time ever, you know, because of the concern about over-levered developers in China, that ended, you know, the music stopped. And
right.
That then led to property prices falling for the first time in, you know, people our age's life. Real estate didn't go up. And that's really weighed on domestic consumption and consumer confidence, which is hurting the economy, which is why they're doing this pivot, you know, really a 180 to try to get real estate prices up.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Like, the, obviously, the stimulus, it's big. How do you think it quote unquote works, or what's like the, you know, and is this it? I mean, are you just anticipating kind of just this is the stance of the central bank there for a long time going forward?
I think why we're constructive, Corey, is that, you know, that we've really seen the monetary policy bazooka, where they've cut interest rates, you know, a whole host of interest rates related to intrabank lending, the deposit rate, the mortgage rate. They've removed a lot of the home purchase restrictions. They've cut the amount of money necessary for a down payment. They're allowing this massive refinancing of all mortgages in China to put money back into households' wallets, so to speak. But what we've only seen the start of is the fiscal stimulus. And on the fiscal stimulus, what they've said is, we're going to, you know, provide subsidies to auto purchases. That's hybrid and electric vehicle, but also ICE, internal combustion engines. We're going to provide subsidies for people to buy new home appliances, refrigerators, air conditioners. But it's only really the start. And what we think will come out over the next several weeks is them really saying, you know, we're going to put, 1.5 to 3% of GDP into stimulus geared to raising domestic consumption. Domestic consumption has been very tepid in China. You know, just households have lost money on part of their portfolio, their real estate portfolio. So they still have money. I mean, M2 bank deposits in China is like this, but they need to get people to put money back. They need to get people spending. Now, why they're doing that, which is kind of interesting, is because what's worked in China has been export-driven manufacturing. And now they see their biggest client, the U.S., is cutting interest rates, right? The Fed is saying, hey, the U.S. economy is slowing. And so they know the demand for export-driven manufacturing from China to the U.S., and some of that might be through Vietnam or through Malaysia, Indonesia, or Mexico. So if they know part of their economy is going to slow because of the global economy slowing, they need to raise domestic consumption, which is why they're pushing this button right now. And I think what's interesting is everyone thought they wouldn't do anything before the election, but I don't think they care about the election. They care about their own economy.
Yeah, which gets to another point that you raised right at the beginning about how the Western view on China just in general is, you know, it is what it is. I mean, you could explain it, but that's kind of my question to you is, what does the Western media and even investors and analysts, like, what are like the top two or three things that they get wrong and have wrong about China?
I think one, you know, U.S. businesses are doing really well in China. And every U.S. investor is implicitly invested in China. You know, if you think about Tesla, 25% of revenue, or Apple, 16%, or ExxonMobil, 12%, you know, Qualcomm, Texas Instruments, it's like upwards of 2/3. So business people and investors have been getting along just fine. And the diplomats from both sides have not. And I think the media plays with some of what DC wants. But I think that should make every investor nervous. You know, it should make every, you know, that, you know, if these politicians can't get along, you know, that's a big problem, because a lot of U.S. companies are really dependent on China. You know, we in the West, you know, we outsource our pollution to these poor people. If it's India or China, you know, there's no coal smelters or rare earth processors, you know, here in the U.S. for a reason, because it turns the environment on, you know, into the dark side of the moon, and that's never coming back. And God help us if you know, it should scare people to be like, oh, we want to process rare earths here. Like, I mean, you go out and see what that's done to, you know, the environment, you know, you'd think twice. So I think there's a lot of political rhetoric that's not really economic reality. And, you know, it's like tariffs. Like, you know, the Chinese government doesn't write, you know, Chinese companies don't, you know, Walmart, Home Depot, Costco write the tariff check to the U.S. Treasury. And a lot of that stuff we can't build here. We shouldn't want to build it here. And, you know, I think, you know, China exports deflation. You know, we're a beneficiary to that. So I think the, you know, again, you know, some of the narrative doesn't really fit, you know, the data, and that should make every investor nervous a little bit. You know, if you own Apple or Nike or Boeing or Caterpillar, no China, you know, big problem.
Right. On the other side of that, some years ago, I don't know how long ago it was, I came upon a book called Asian Financial Statements. And the basic idea was, don't trust any of them. So, you know, you got to be extremely careful. What is that like? Do you have, you know, are there standard problems analyzing Asian financial statements? And you can, you know, by all means, focus on China.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, you know, things are improving. You know, big U.S. accounting firms are doing the books on particularly the Hong Kong and U.S. ADRs today. And yes, that's their China subsidiary. So I think the trajectory of improvement is there. You know, the government is pushing for more corporate governance. You know, it's been part of our counsel to investors is, you know, to be diversified, you know, that there can be problems with individual companies. You know, Evergrande was audited by a big US 4 accounting firm. So, you know, that's a little bit self-serving again, because, you know, obviously we provide baskets of exposure, but there's an argument for being diversified to try, if there is a bad apple, that it doesn't sink the proverbial ship. But I think the trajectory is improving. You know, what's probably missed a little bit is the role of U.S. private equity in China and emerging markets, that, you know, a lot of these companies that we're invested in were funded by, you know, U.S. companies, U.S. private equity, venture capital that went into China in the early 2000s and became the Alibabas and Tencents and others. So those companies have had to deal with a Western investor mindset, which is why they act differently than in mainland China. It's been more the domestic investor is the main investor. So that investor is, you know, not quite arguably to the same standard, which again is why we recommend you know, being you know, diversified, particularly on that onshore China space.
What do you make of David Tepper's comment? David Tepper, a famous fund manager who's been in the news about China recently, he was asked what he's buying in China. He said everything. Yeah. as someone who sells baskets of Chinese equities, that should make you pretty happy.
It's a great validation to hear the enthusiasm to, you know, from such a legend of our business. And, yeah, you know, again, he's a hedge fund, so he can hedge, right? And he can move really quickly. But I think, sure, you know, he started coming into the space, to his credit, you know, probably about 2 quarters ago. And, you can see his 13Fs he does publicly file. So he was early. I mean, and that's part of what, you know, I think makes him a legend, right? You know, part of his reputation is to be a contrarian. And, you know, I think that's part of his great, great reputation is going against the grain, which, you know, the media, you know, was telling, you know, probably saying he was out of his mind, and, you know, he went and did it, you know, but, you know, I, you know, tip my hat to him.
Right. So spelling out the question, a more specific question from that is just, you know, the idea of buying everything. Is there something you like? I guess the real question would be, is there something you like better than something else in China right now? Or is it really, because of the nature of the easing and everything and the fiscal stimulus to come, is it like you're just buying China, you're buying the baskets?
Yeah. I think like Dan would say, like, you know, you're buying beta. You're just, you know, you want to buy the market. And, you know, on Monday, it was amazing. You know, there's over 5,000 stocks listed on the Shanghai and Shenzhen Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. Four went down. I mean, four. I mean, you're just like,
for those four.
I mean, over five. I mean, I was going to look like, what were those four names? Over 5,000.
So a somewhat 000. Broad rally. Yeah.
Just a touch, just a smidge. And, it was very, Hong Kong doesn't have nearly as many stocks listed there, but it was similar. Like literally no stocks went down. And so that's, I think, what Tepper was just saying. Like, you just want to hit the side of the barn. Can you imagine being the guy or gal that, you know, their definition of China was one of those four stocks that went down? So I think, he's just saying own it all. I mean, I think where we would, our communication investors is like, you got this onshore China, Shanghai, Shenzhen, and then you have this offshore Hong Kong in the 80s.
Right.
And this is where we kind of say like KBA versus KWEB. And again, there's a lot of other China ETFs from competitors out there. So don't just look at our stuff, but where a lot of that PBOC governor was saying was for the KBA names, where he was saying that is what the Chinese government really cares about, because it's the domestic investor. It owns those same stocks. And then you have foreign investors. They really want these growth stocks like we hold in KWEB, the Alibabas and Tencents and Meituans. Mm-hmm. And the foreign investors will kind of come back to those growth names in Hong Kong. And so I think as an investor, you have to think about, self-serving and highly, I own them both because I can't predict which one's going to do better. I've lost a lot of money over the last 3.5 years in them both. And I'm not quite back to even, but I'm getting there. But I think you'd have to say, like, what's going to drive this? And I think there's arguments for both camps, but they're not interdependent. They're very different investor bases, so they can do very different things. And I think, you'd say the domestic investor.
Actually,
in
Brendan, before you go on, though, the names overlap, or are we saying the names don't overlap, or they do overlap? They're just dramatically different investor bases.
They don't overlap. They do not overlap.
Okay, so the names don't overlap. I got you. All right, here we go.
Yep,
that's good.
They don't, and then and there's no fungibility. There are a smaller set of companies that are dual listed, but there's no fungibility. You can't switch back and forth, and that's part of why they move so different. So, you kind of say, is the domestic investor going to get really excited? And I would say, I think so. And back in 2014, 2015, you had a big, big bull market in mainland China. It got a little out of hand in terms of leverage. They're not going to let that happen again. But I also think foreign investors are really, really underweight China. And just some of that money coming back in, it's real money, and that will take time. That will take time. And Dan and Corey, I'd say, like, listen, China's done, made huge policy mistakes over the last few years, huge PR blunders. It's just, there's a lot of things they've done that, is why these stocks have done so badly, why they're so underweight, and they're arguably trying to change some of that, some of the political stuff in DC, and that may or may not go away. It's hard to say.
Right. Do you have any view on the prospects for war in Taiwan?
We've been, I think the most important thing is that China saw what happened to Russia. And that is why we don't believe they will invade Taiwan militarily. That China's economy is very geared to the West, that they're very dependent upon export-driven manufacturing. And Russia had nothing to lose because it's not integrated in the global economy. I mean, yes, they've got oil and some metals, China, you know, China cannot afford not to export to Europe, to the United States. You know, their economy would just collapse. The other reason we've been very skeptical is the U.S. Navy, you know, the U.S. Navy. the U.S. spends more, you know, on defense than the next nine countries, including China. You know, we have 16 aircraft carriers. They have two, one of which is this, you know, rust bucket they bought from. And if you know, when you go to Asia, you know, if you parked one of our 16 aircraft carriers in the Strait of Malacca outside of Singapore, China would starve without Middle East oil. I mean, the economy would collapse. So, you know, I think, you know, we obviously want, you know, the U.S. government is very clearly going to support Taiwan. And I think that's a huge deterrent. I don't know why there's some skepticism about the U.S., you know, our great military. You know, it's a great deterrent for China doing something militarily. In the long run, you know, it's a patriotic issue in China. You know, Taiwan was part of China. And, you know, they want it back in the long run. I just don't think you do the mental math. It just doesn't make any sense to do it militarily.
Right. So my understanding is that Taiwan was kind of a product of the communist revolution. They, you know, people sort of escaped to there, and obviously they had a non-communist system, and economically it worked, and you know, things change. I'm not going to profess to have some sharp view on this and to know how it ought to be. You know, it will be the way it will be, and it doesn't matter what we think. But there's a case to be made that it's like a different country now. It's not the same.
For sure. I mean, it's a complicated issue. You know, it goes back to the Opium War. You know, we're talking to 1860. You know, the British, the French, the Russians, Americans. You know, most people don't realize, you know, U.S. Marines were based in Shanghai less than 100 years ago. We owned a piece of Shanghai, because after the Opium War, the emperor was dethroned and we got a piece of it along with the Germans, French, Dutch. It's a really complicated issue. And I agree, Dan, you know, no one in Taiwan has lived under Chinese rule since 1901, when the Japanese invaded, which was part of the events that led to World War II. So it's a really complicated issue. I couldn't agree more.
Right. And we don't get the clarity of a sort of Hong Kong situation. It's that, well, we'll keep it, then we'll give it back. And that'll be, you know, tough. It's a tough thing, but 100%. I'm reassured. And I find your comments reassuring and sensible. It seems to me the Chinese don't seem like they're, or maybe I'll let you tell me this, but it just doesn't seem like they're so, just utterly jingoistically, however, or isolationist or whatever you'd have to be, however you want to describe that, to cut themselves off from the world, you know, via the inevitable sanctions that would result. So, But I see headlines. Like, I have a headline I have on my personal computer here that it popped up on Financial Times, and it says U.S. Navy SEAL unit that killed Osama bin Laden trains for China invasion of Taiwan. Now, in and of itself, right? That it's just a headline, right? It doesn't mean any, you know, we're going to war or anything. It's clearly an attempt to get eyeballs on the Financial Times. I get all that. Maybe that headline just speaks to what you're saying, that the disconnect between Western media and what's really going on in China. Is it that simple?
I think Taiwan is a issue of patriotism in China, and for the Chinese government, they have a constituency that says this should be ours, and they have to speak to that, you know, domestic constituency. At the same time, I think, you know, there is a recognition that that Taiwan, you know, it's been off on its own for a while. I think, you know, the experience of China coming, you know, the British giving Hong Kong back and the problems that have come with the Hong Kong is, so there's, yeah, I think ultimately, you know, China needs stability. You know, you look at a map of China, we've got them surrounded. You know, some of the biggest military bases for the U.S., South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, Australia, you know, India, you know, and China, Northwest China, you know, they've had a lot of problems, you know, because of Afghanistan, right? You know, so China, you know, is surrounded to some degree. And then I think more importantly, just the, you know, their economy is geared to the West. You know, they need us, we need them. And that should be a great deterrent, you know, that cooler heads prevail.
Right. All right. That's good. I'm satisfied on the issue of Taiwan.
Yeah. The one thing I was going to say was, Dan and Corey, is, you know, Google this thing called Kinmen County. Kinmen County is part of Taiwan that sits just 3 miles off of the mainland China. That, you know, most of the big island of Taiwan is 100 miles away. Kinmen County is part of Taiwan. It sits 3 miles away. And when you use Google Maps, you'd say people live there. And you'd say if people thought they're about to roll in, that would be the last place on earth you would live. But you'll use Google Maps, you see houses and high schools, and it just, you know, it just shows that, listen, some
of
this,
it's nice.
I've not been. I've been to Taiwan, which was nice and recommend, but I just say, you know, Kinmen County just shows a little bit of what the locals in Taiwan think about the probability of the tanks rolling in. You know, the place would be abandoned if they thought that was the case.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I was going to ask you about the kind of economic reality domestically there. I mean, all things being equal, say there's no war threats happening. There's no horrible real estate situation. What does the Chinese economy have going for it, you know, right now with, you know, either the population, demographics, whatever it may be, domestically, say the stimulus works as planned, how would that play out?
I think it's you know, the next leg of stimulus, it will be geared to the domestic consumption story, and I think that'll benefit, you know, a lot of U.S. multinationals in China. That if they can get consumer confidence up, people will start spending more. But then there's certainly a lot of domestic companies are great beneficiaries. If it's, you know, there's the e-commerce companies that do 26% of retail sales. You know, there, as consumer confidence rises, people will travel more domestically, internationally. They'll eat out more. You know, they'll spend more on apparel, you know, and cosmetics. So I think there's a whole host of domestic as well as international companies that will benefit from the rise of domestic consumption. And I think we can anticipate that this export-driven manufacturing will slow as the global economy slows, as the U.S. economy is slowing a bit. There'll be less demand for those goods. So they'll see, I think, a little bit of the handing the baton within the domestic economy from export-driven manufacturing to this domestic consumption story.
Is Crane Shares in any Taiwan names or just mainland China?
So we did, we have an emerging market version. You know, our flagship fund, KWEB, is very focused on the China growth stocks, internets. But we had an investor that said, hey, can you do that for emerging markets? Like, you know, I don't buy countries, you know, that's so specific. You know, I buy EM. So KEMQ is kind of the EM version of KWEB, and it does include Taiwan. It includes the Taiwan semis, South Korea, Indonesia, Malaysia. So it kind of just takes the KWEB thesis, applies it to broad EM. So we do have exposure to Taiwan, But we also, work with a lot of investors in Taiwan. I've been there numerous times.
All right. Do you have any view on the United States Technology Act? I forget what it's called, but that's going to push money into, among other places, semiconductors, and investing in semiconductor manufacturing in the United States, which of course would tend to draw some of that away from Taiwan.
Yeah, I think it's to me it seems very logical that the chips that the U.S. military needs are produced domestically. So, Taiwan Semi's, building this plant in Arizona. And that makes a lot of sense. Today, there's a typhoon hitting Taiwan. And so the markets were closed, but, it just shows that, natural disaster, forget China or, they actually had an earthquake in Taiwan about a month or two ago. And, it thankfully was not near where Taiwan Semi's plant is. But imagine, a major just earthquake, the whole world is dependent upon this one company, and so I think for the U.S. military, it makes just a whole, makes tons of sense that be made here. Should this be made here? Probably not, because you can only sell it to not even 400 million people, where you build it in China, you can then sell it to not just their, 1.5, you can sell it to the 4 billion people in Asia. You can put it on a plane and fly it here, no problem. So I think some of the bring it back argument, I'm pretty skeptical of. I think part of that is this, the Chinese companies are really moving to China plus one, that, when the Chinese government shuttered the port of Shanghai because of zero COVID policy, Chinese companies were like, we viewed it as a supply chain problem. For Chinese companies, they're like, we have a revenue problem. We can't get our stuff to our clients. And they're the ones going into Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Mexico to diversify their supply chain in order to protect their revenue stream. So this idea of, we're going to bring it all back. And that's where I'm like, honestly, I don't think you want more coal steel smelters in America. I don't think you want to process rare earths here, because, our blue skies go away. That's just a fact, because of the, we're willing to, we outsource it to, we pollute them, not us.
Yeah. I mean, there are ways to do it without polluting, but they get expensive. It just makes more sense to do it elsewhere. Let's talk. I want to go back and talk about being data driven. At this point, when somebody says data driven, I'm like, yeah, you and everybody else. So the way to do that, I think, is to distinguish Crane from any, the way anybody else might use data to, analyze and pick stocks in China and do other things in China that you do with data.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have argued, the data is all made up and this, that, a lot of these companies, they're audited by, but the big four U.S. accounting firms, and, just take that, that's just the facts. But I think around some of the government data, people were like, the government just makes it up. But I think what a lot of investors don't recognize is that this thing is a mobile surveillance device, that, when I drive down the street and I decide to go to Walmart instead of Target, that data is being sold, is being packaged and sold to, the largest US asset managers and hedge funds. These free apps on your phone, why are they free? Because in that 15 pages you scroll through, you're giving that app free rein to your phone. And, we've all had this experience where you're like, man, I was talking to my friend on the phone about, my vacation to, Myrtle Beach, and you know, when I turned my phone back on, you know, I had all these ads for hotels in Myrtle Beach. Like, so these things are mobile surveillance devices, and that's true in China. So every month, you know, we're getting data on, you know, what are people buying? You know, what video games are being downloaded the most in China? You know, then there's actually, and it's funny that you're trying to have this new game, that's become a huge sensation, and we know it's doing so well because they're selling the data, and that's true for the e-commerce companies. They're selling all of this data. So, you know, we don't need government data, because you have firms that aggregate it up. They're screen scraping the internet in China. My favorite, and we don't use it, but there's this company, just Google it. It's I'm just blown away by that. It's called Space Now, Space KNOW. And they fly satellites all over the world, taking photos of factories and train station parking lots and malls. And so you can go to them and say, like, you know, how many cars is Tesla going to build in Fremont versus Shanghai? And they can do that based on how much steel and aluminum is sitting in the storage areas. And so, you know, there's all this data out there that's available. That's not from the government. It's from research firm. It's from these, you know, these companies that aggregate app data and are screen scraping. And it gives us a really, really good indication of what's really going on there. So, you know, forget the GDP data or, you know, the government, you know, you don't need it. You don't, it's 2024. And I don't think most investors, you know, understand that.
The idea of this company Space Now is a little scary.
Oh, yeah.
They know everything from space, I think is what the name of that is trying to tell us. I mean, but they just have image after image here of, you know, just detailed factories and airports and all kinds of things that they're showing you.
That's really interesting. Reminds me of driving past the port of Baltimore here and looking at how many cars are there or not to see how, see what's going on with the auto industry.
And Corey, I mean, you know, there's hedge funds that are, you know, there's data firms, they're paying someone to sit out there and count it. You know, that they're putting a drone over that part, you know, and that's true in, you know, outside of the port of Dalian or Shanghai or Hong. I mean, there's people, their job is to sit and be like, you know, how big was that boat? How many containers were on it? And, you know, it's just, I mean, it's things have really evolved from being like, I need the National Bureau of Statistics to tell me, you know, what retail sales was, you know, every month. I knew that weeks ago, you know, real time.
Right. Yep.
That's cool. So actually I still, maybe then since that was a longer discussion than I, sum it up for our listener then. What's, you know, if you had to say, hey, how does CraneShares use all this data that, you know, in ways that might give them an advantage? Put it that way for our listener.
Well, I think we're producing research that's leveraging that. I mean, you know, just yesterday I met with Alibaba in New York, and you know, so I'll be writing about, hey, you know, I met, you know, their head of PR was in our office, and you know, they were showing, you know, they showed showed me this incredible video of how they're using AI to facilitate say US or global, you know, global people buying and selling goods. I mean, from China or from Germany or from the US, you know, incredible and just incredible. And so, you know, we're trying to provide that insight. And I think, you know, most of us get our, you know, we get our China views from Western media. And I think, you know, they're paid to get clicks, which is, you know, some of the hyperbole, exaggeration, and populism. And, you know, we want to provide people a perspective of what's really happening. And yeah, we're investors. You know, the only way I get paid is if people buy our ETFs. I mean, that's some, you know, at the same time, you know, we're small business owners. Every piece of idealism in me has been snuffed out in trying to build a company. But, you know, I have kids and they got to grow up in a world with China. And, you know, maybe we're building a little bit of a bridge. You know, maybe people say, hey, you know, if we can communicate with Chinese companies, you know, maybe the politicians should as well, you know. But yeah, I think it's really about just providing that data. And I say to people like, you know, Dan Corey, like, we should be just a tiny part of a portfolio. You're like, we're super volatile. You're super volatile. Mm-hmm. And so you got to downplay it. Like, you know, you got to say, hey, this is just a small piece of a well-diversified portfolio. But I think, you know, we do think there's an opportunity. We've had a big run here. You know, maybe you wait for pullbacks and corrections inevitably. But yeah, we do think there's an opportunity. And if you know, what a lot of investors don't think they understand is, you know, we get this West, you know, this U.S. media narrative. But outside of the U.S., you know, when you travel in Asia or the Middle East or Europe or, you know, it's a very different media narrative because they do a lot of business with China. You know, China, and you go to any commodity country, their number one client is China. You think their media is bashing China every day? Like, no. You know, if you're in Switzerland or Germany, you know, huge trade. I mean, you know, Audi, Volkswagen, you know, one of the largest producers of cars in China, you know, or Roche or AstraZeneca, you know, huge operating. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, that I think is underestimated a little bit. And that's where, yeah, we're not rooting against U.S. equities. I mean, you know, I'm heavily personally invested, but we just think there is an opportunity for diversification, which, you know, hasn't really worked in quite some time.
All right. So sort of putting it all together, then there's a focus on China and you're outside the mainstream media bubble. You're in the room with these people. And you're using data that maybe other institutions use it, but the average investor doesn't use any of this stuff. And you've, you know, you didn't start doing this like last week. It's interesting to me. You have become very interesting to me during this interview. And I'll be certainly paying a lot more attention to Crane after this. What size AUM for the whole company?
We're just over 10 billion today, Dan. And I'd say one thing, okay. I just want to, you know, your former colleague, retired colleague, Dr. Steve Sugarud, was very instrumental he got interested in our firm and, we ended up going, you know, bringing Steve to China. You know, Steve was like, you know, Brendan, I'm calling your bluff. Yeah. I don't believe you. And I think that just shows one of the value adds I've always felt about Stansberry is, you know, we've never paid $1 to Stansberry. And that's something that I think your subscribers should maybe understand is that you're not beholden to, you know, people like me because we're not paying you anything. And that's that objectivity, that lack of bias, I think is something that's really important for, you know, that Stansberry does. And, you know, if it's Brett Eversole or Vic and Chris and team, you know, down, you know, been great stewards of that, you know, from Steve and yourself as, you know, stewards of Stansberry today.
Yeah. Like you would never be on, if any of that other stuff were true about money or whatever, you'd never be on the program and nobody at Stansberry would ever have anything to do with you. So,
Yes, we should take this opportunity to remind people that
we need to
take advertising dollars. So,
yeah. I just think it's something that your end subscribers should recognize that, you know, you won't go down that path and that objectivity, that lack of bias is so critical. I think today where, you know, I think a lot of the media narrative is driven by a monetary incentive to get people to click.
Yeah. To be honest, if the podcast does ever take advertising dollars, I want our listener to know I don't give a shit. I will piss off every advertiser when I damn well please, and they can fire me if they don't like it. Just so you know, just covering the future, just so the listener knows. All right,
you're saying they won't be advertising for long. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, they'll advertise once, and then they'll have a guest on from that company, and I'll tell him he's an idiot, and then that'll be the end of it. We are at the point when we can ask our final question. It's the same for every guest, no matter what the topic, even if it's a non-financial topic. Same question. If you've already said the answer, feel free to repeat it. There's no problem with that. And the final question is this. If you could leave our listener with a single thought today, what would you like it to be?
Stay inquisitive. I think that's something that, the people that gravitate us, they don't buy a narrative that they're spoon-fed. They're not choosing to receive opinions that affirm their beliefs. I think they really come to us for that data-driven, we're biased, but we try to be balanced, and we're not apologists. There's been some real problems over there, policy errors. But stay inquisitive, and I kind of say, go see it yourself. Give it a shot. I think when you challenge, some of your own beliefs, you come out a better person. And I think that's something that, Steve Sugarud taught me was, I'm calling your bluff, go show it to me. And, I think that inquisitive nature is probably inherent to most of your subscribers.
Great answer. Thank you for that. And thanks for being here, Brendan. Really great conversation. Really enjoyed talking with you.
No, man. Mutually. Thank you so much, Dan and Corey. It's a pleasure. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
Hi, this is Dan Ferris with a special announcement regarding the upcoming Stansberry Conference and Alliance meeting. In-person tickets to the event are now sold out, but you can still see the Vegas action live with a discounted live stream pass. Go to StansberryVegas2024.com to get your virtual pass today. We've got some spectacular things planned for this year's event, including founder Porter Stansberry will sit down on stage with best-selling author Michael Lewis, who wrote famed financial books like Moneyball, The Big Short, and Flash Boys. I'm personally really excited for this, as it's sure to be a can't-miss interview. Other top-notch speakers include an artificial intelligence expert, a former governor, and the CIA's former chief of disguise. All your favorite Stansberry editors will be there too, presenting their top ideas and stock picks like Doc Eifrig, Eric Wade, and Greg Diamond. I'll be on stage as well, sharing my annual State of the Market address, and I think some of what I have to say this year may surprise a lot of you. Our live stream pass allows you to log in to our event right from your phone or computer in the comfort of your own home, no travel required. You'll also have access to our post-event presentations, meaning you can pause or rewind as many times as you'd like through the end of the year. All the incredible information and stock tips will be right at your fingertips. Go to www.StansberryVegas2024.com right now to secure your virtual live stream pass. That's www.StansberryVegas2024.com. That guy's a lot of fun to talk with. He knows a lot about China, and he's really easy to talk to. I'm glad we had him on the show.
Me too. I knew of his, what you were talking about there at the end, I knew of his history there with Steve a little bit. But it was good to talk to him personally and get a kind of independent view on what's happening in China, what's going on there, his view. And what works with stimulus, the difference between domestic and the foreign companies. Anybody who admits, he's running this obviously China-focused ETF company, but to just put a small amount into it, that speaks to some integrity as well. So it was good to talk to him. Yeah.
Right. When a guy starts out by saying, "We don't sell fear and greed," I joked about it, I said, "Oh, well, we don't want to talk to you." That's of course, exactly, that's a joke because it's exactly what we want. We want someone who's, knows all this wild data that he talked about knowing and uses it to, give a really, more objective view, to get outside the mainstream media bubble and get in the room with these people. I thought that was great. I mean, it makes me want to pay a lot more attention to what they're doing. And I signed up for his blog at chinalastnight.com, which he told us about after we turned off the recording button, chinalastnight.com, which apparently was not his idea. It was Steve Sugarwood's idea. And then he started doing it. So Steve's had a lot of good ideas, and I guess this is another one of them. Yeah.
A personal note to Steve that became a newsletter. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. All right. Well, that's another interview, and that's another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I hope you enjoyed it every bit as much as we did. We do provide a transcript for every episode. Just go to www.investorhour.com, click on the episode you want, scroll all the way down, click on the word transcript, and enjoy. If you like this episode and know anybody else who might like it, tell them to check it out on their podcast app or at investorhour.com, please. And also, do me a favor, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, help us grow with a rate and a review. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @InvestorHour. On Twitter, our handle is @Investor_Hour. Have a guest you want us to interview? Drop us a note at feedback@investorhour.com or call our listener feedback line, 800-381-2357. Tell us what's on your mind and hear your voice on the show. For my co-host, Corey McLaughlin, until next week, I'm Dan Ferris. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email, feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.
Opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the contributor and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Stansberry Research, its parent company, or affiliates. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this program as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of opinion. Neither Stansberry Research nor its parent company or affiliates warrant the completeness or accuracy of the information expressed on this program, and it should not be relied upon as such. Stansberry Research, its affiliates and subsidiaries are not under any obligation to update or correct any information provided on the program. The statements and opinions expressed on this program are subject to change without notice. No part of the contributor's compensation from Stansberry Research is related to the specific opinions they express. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Stansberry Research does not guarantee any specific outcome or profit. You should be aware of the real risk of loss in following any strategy or investment discussed on this program. Strategies or investments discussed may fluctuate in price or value. Investors may get back less than invested. Investments or strategies mentioned on this program may not be suitable for you. This material does not take into account your particular investment objectives, financial situation, or needs, and is not intended as a recommendation that is appropriate for you. You must make an independent decision regarding investments or strategies mentioned on this program. Before acting on information on the program, you should consider whether it is suitable for your particular circumstances and strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial or investment advisor.